in 2012, a 38-year-old man named Ian Thorson, on the search for spiritual transcendence, climbed up to the top of a mountain in Arizona. He was with his wife, a woman who was anointed a goddess by an eccentric Buddhist community. Their goal was nothing short of achieving the final state of spiritual perfection known as enlightenment. Now, most of us have the idea that enlightenment is a laudable goal to try to achieve. I mean, it seems so obvious. Nirvana, compassion, a true understanding of the reason why we're all here. It seems like something that, well, we should all try to attain. Unfortunately, in the case of Ian Thorson and so many other people that I have come across in my career living in India and as an investigative journalist, the search for enlightenment can also go terribly, terribly wrong. In Ian Thorson's case, his search for enlightenment ended up with him dehydrating in the Arizona desert until the only person who could possibly save him was his wife, who was wearing all white robes, an anointed goddess who could save him by just pressing a button on a spot locator beacon or phoning the sheriff to call a helicopter. And yet she had to make a decision whether her own journey towards enlightenment was worth forsaking in favor of her own journey towards spiritual perfection. Now, over the years, I have done a tremendous amount of investigation onto what happens when the search for spiritual transcendence goes wrong. For me, it started back in 2006 when I was leading this abroad program through North India with 12 wonderfully bright students under my direct care. And we're going to all of the holy sites through North India. We started at Nizamuddin in Delhi, traveled to the holy city of the dead of Varanasi, and ended up in Bodh Gaya, where we were going to take a 7-day silent meditation retreat in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. On the 7th day of that silent meditation, my best, my brightest student, this beautiful woman named Emily O'Connor, climbed up to the roof of the Root Institute in Bodh Gaya. After journaling and telling us exactly what was on her mind, she jumped off the roof to her death. It was my responsibility to bring her body back to the United States and coordinate with the police and understand exactly what was going through her mind when she took her own life. This instigating incident has really been at the center of all of the works that I have ever done. Because in those moments, those 3 days in 102 degree heat, as I was trying to preserve the flesh of her body, it opened me up to the material reality that all of us will one day die. All of us will go from being beautiful and engaging people to what is scarily, little more than just meat in the control of other people. This initially led me to writing a book on organ trafficking called The Red Market. But the entire time that I was doing that, in that 6-year journey, I was also thinking, well, why did Emily O'Connor take her own life? I mean, in her journal, the last words were, "I am a bodhisattva," which means that I am something like a Tibetan Buddhist angel on the cusp of enlightenment. And I had to wonder, well, was she on the cusp of enlightenment? What is enlightenment anyway? I traveled across North India trying to answer those questions. I met with Tibetan Buddhist lamas and fakirs in the Islamic tradition. I met with Hindu holy men asking them all the same question. Well, was she enlightened? Could you, through intensive silent meditation, get to a point where you knew the ultimate truth of all of reality? Well, most of those lamas that I spoke with said no, that enlightenment doesn't end in suicide. Enlightenment is a process of constant reimagining and recreating your own position in reality. It is a way to make yourself a better person. It is not a final step in which you must end yourself in death. That is madness. And yet, I was also seeing this same madness occur all across India. I wrote an article for Details Magazine on something called India Syndrome, when people go to India from a Western background and they suddenly come to believe that they are somehow perfect. They have somehow maybe embodied the true nature of Shiva. They have found enlightenment on a meditation retreat. And about 100 people a year were ending up in mental asylums in Delhi and in Mumbai. Other people were taking their own lives. And so I started collecting journals from people who had meditated and gotten into a very, very difficult position. Now, of course, meditation is not bad. I mean, meditation has these amazing benefits, and I'm not someone who's going out there trying to tell you that you should never pursue these traditions. I'm an avid meditator myself, but it's not just inherently good. There's also this other side to it. There's this side of potential madness. Just like if you were taking a psychedelic, you know, many people take psychedelics and have these amazing, amazing experiences. Other people end up in the hospitals. Other people go crazy. I have one friend who jumped out of a window because he was on mushrooms, because he was telling himself, you know, some people on mushrooms end up jumping out windows. And that idea just went cyclically in his head until he did jump out of a window. Luckily, he ended up ultimately being okay and survived to tell me the tale of that. And yet, these spiritual practitioners, so many of us go to these superheated yoga studios. We bow our heads saying namaste at the end of the practice, as if these words, because they're said in a foreign language, somehow contain a deeper spiritual meaning. Well, I mean, I don't know if you knew this, but the word namaste, the way it's used in India, is more like chow than the divine light in me hails and honors the divine light in you. Now, you could say that the word hello is a word that has some deep spiritual meaning, or in Spanish, adios, literally means to God. But that's not the way that we use it on a day-to-day basis. And yet, in the yoga studio, we clasp our hands, we bow our heads, and we say that this practice was so wonderful that the divine light in me does recognize and hail the divine light in you. And we think that these spiritual words somehow make us more spiritual. And I think that there's something particularly strong about the American desire to reach and transcend, to become better and more spiritually advanced people. It sort of links in with this idea of the Protestant work ethic and the spirit of capitalism. That's Max Weber's description of it. It's when you believe that through your good works, that it is a sign of God's favor. That's what the Calvinists were all into, right? You work hard and you get the fruits of your labor, and that is a sign that God is smiling down on you. And while many of us don't particularly agree with the Christian tradition, when we look east, there are these meditative practices that they have. It's in the Yoga Sutras. It's this idea that you can achieve superpowers, which in Sanskrit are called siddhis. You can achieve superpowers such as levitating, such as telepathy, such as walking through walls, such as superheating your body in really cold environments. You can achieve these siddhis if only you dedicate yourself to the practice so much more. And, you know, in America, we also really, really like superheroes, right? We like Superman. We like Batman, although he, I guess, wasn't a real superhero. But we like these people who can achieve things through their works and through their innate specialness. And when that mixes with these esoteric Indian traditions, well, honestly, for some people, they become so fixated on this next moment that they go mad in that pursuit. I don't think many of them actually get superpowers. In fact, I don't think any of them have gotten superpowers. The transcendental meditators who have been studying levitation in Iowa for at least the last 50 years, the goal for them is to levitate, and yet all they can do is hop on their mat. Superpowers are not actually achievable, but the pursuit of superpowers can be maddening. All right, so all of this is a preface for me to tell you that I really, really want you to take a look at my brand new book, The Enlightenment Trap: Obsession, Madness, and Death on Diamond Mountain. These are the things that I have investigated and I've put my heart and soul into 4 years. It is the book that came before my New York Times bestseller, What Doesn't Kill Us. And then I have re-released it. I've put in new chapters. I have put in photos. I have really made the book the way that I always wanted it to be. It's got this awesome cover, and it's got a great, great audiobook. Now, I have just re-released it back in March, and I got a little sidetracked. I don't know if you've looked at other things that I've done, but I've got a little sidetracked with exposing some issues that I've seen in the Wim Hof method, and I maybe didn't give this book the full launch that it should have. So what I'm going to do is, for the remainder of this podcast, I'm going to play you the prologue of The Enlightenment Trap, because I want you to hear what it's really all about, and then I want you to go check it out on Audible or Apple or wherever it is that you get your podcasts, and I want you to download this book and listen to it, because it really, really, well, it's one of the most important things that I've ever written. It is narrative nonfiction. It will drag you through the story, keeping you on the edge of your seats the entire time. So this, without further ado, this is the prologue to my book, The Enlightenment Trap. Here we go. Christy McNally's hair hung down in greasy, unwashed cords as she scanned the retreat valley with her tired brown eyes. The searing yellow flashlight beams hadn't cut across the tract for at least a week, but that didn't mean their pursuit was over. A month earlier, devotees had bowed at her feet and laid garlands of flowers on her throne. Now, guards patrolled the property line, wary of any attempt she might make to reassert control of her flock. Her white robes, long since soiled, were packed away in one of the watertight Rubbermaid tubs that they'd stashed beneath the cave they now occupied. There were still a few of their loyal Buddhist followers out there somewhere. She'd written a message to them in a bubbly, girlish scrawl. Her struggle had a place in the landscape's grand sweep of history. They'd been expelled from their own slice of Eden and hounded so that she and her husband, Ian Thorson, had, quote, started to feel this terrible sense of being hunted like a wild rabbit or perhaps an Apache of long ago. It was an apt metaphor. 150 years earlier, Indians, armed with rifles and stolen ammunition, squatted on a ridge not far from here. They watched the valley as Union soldiers refreshed their canteens at Bear Spring and waited for the perfect moment to strike. As the soldiers quenched their thirst, the reports of Apache rifles echoed off the canyon walls. Two bullets found their marks. The privates bled out within minutes, their blue uniforms turned purple, and the ground soaked up their blood as greedily as it did their spilled canteens. The lieutenant survived to record their passing in a report to his commanding officer at Fort Bowie, whose low adobe walls stood only a quarter mile away. The murders were just another step in the tit-for-tat violence that culminated in 75 years of barbarism known by the victors as the Indian Wars. Vestiges of that violence remained when McNally helped raise money to buy the valley in 2008 and rechristened it Diamond Mountain. Bear Spring silted over and stopped flowing only a few months after the Buddhists arrived. Some locals thought it was a sign. When they moved here, McNally and Thorson saw the cave as a spiritual refuge in the tradition of the great Himalayan masters. Their plan was as elegant as it was treacherous. They would occupy the cave until they achieved enlightenment. They didn't expect that they might die trying. Ian Thorson was thin now, too thin, really. The knife wounds in his sides and shoulders had healed cleanly, but now a fresh bruise swept across his forehead. He'd been delirious for some time, and in his frustration, he'd smashed his head with a piece of hardened plastic. It wasn't his fault that the situation didn't make sense anymore. She worried about him hurting himself further. Then again, he was so close to greatness. McNally knew that when he looked up from the mattress they'd hauled up to their mountain cave, he wouldn't see the guileless face of the girl who grew up outside of Los Angeles, the product of an affair between her father and his secretary. Nor would he identify the outline of the woman with whom he'd helped build Diamond Mountain University into a major site for Tibetan Buddhist meditation. It was not the woman with whom he'd spent countless hours perfecting the intricate postures of couples yoga, where they would use each other's weight to push their bodies into impossible configurations. She certainly wasn't the ex-wife of his first guru and spiritual teacher, Geshe Michael Roach, who was still jealously stewing over their controversial split. No. When he gazed out of the dimming aperture of the cave, he would see an angel made of clear white light. Christy McNally was his lover and his lama, the enlightened being who had seen the nature of emptiness directly, who had married him and taken his tortured soul from a base understanding of the world to the cusp of his own transformation. She was also his only hope for making it out of here alive. Even if he could stand, the cave was barely tall enough for Thorson to be on his feet without craning his 6-foot frame. During daytime, a small sliver of light filtered through a hole in the roof where the rocks formed a cleft. It was stuffed with all of the things they had thought they would need to survive a long haul. There were bags of basmati rice, bolts of clothing and cold weather gear, flashlights and jars of Italian seasoning. A small ritual instrument hung from a hook on the rock ceiling. It was tuned like a Jamaican steel drum and helped ease them into meditation. They had propane and Costco brand baby wipes, duct tape, Tibetan incense, a filtration device, and heavy black plastic bags full of junk. The only thing they didn't have was what they needed most, water. Thick with poisonous snakes, mountain lions, and prickly cactus, the Chiricahua Mountains of southeast Arizona are prone to landslides and are unforgiving to outsiders. Leaving the cave was an ordeal that left them exhausted and panting for breath. Since they'd arrived a month ago, the temperature on the mountainside had been unpredictable. One day it would be hot enough to melt the soles of their hiking boots. The next, a freak snowstorm might coat the rocks, yucca, and scrub oak with a fine layer of ice. Scorching desert winds whisked away what was left of their moisture. Despite the lashing from the cold, they thought a recent ice storm was a blessing in disguise. It might have saved them from dehydration. When he still had some strength, Thorson arranged a tarp to collect the runoff from the melt and funnel it into a jug of water that was long since dry. They drank from the impromptu reservoir, and the dirty container sat on the cave floor, bristling with twigs. It wasn't long until Ian began to feel sick. His guts cramped, and he began to shiver with fever. He donned 3 sweaters and crept beneath a blanket to beat the fever back, but it wasn't enough. His face turned from ghost white to a deep shade of purple. They had 3 things that might help stave off the sickness. First, of course, there was the power of prayer. They'd carved Tibetan words into a rock to sanctify the space and purify their spiritual path. Though meaningless in themselves, the syllables, Om Ah Hung in Tibetan, invoked a powerful connection to their guru, which the holy texts said would restore their body, speech, and mind, as well as balance the wheels of energy in their body, called chakras. Next to the carving was a course book devoted to Kali, the Hindu goddess of destruction. On its cover, the bare-chested goddess clutched the severed head of an adversary and wore a skirt made of dismembered limbs. Kali is a fierce protector of her devotees, but she is known to take her payment in blood. Near the ritual accoutrements was one more important option, a sort of escape hatch if all else failed. Sheathed in orange plastic, the satellite personal tracker, or SPOT locator beacon, was capable of sending out 2 prearranged distress calls. If Christy pressed the button marked HELP, their GPS coordinates would arc toward a geostationary satellite and into the inboxes of their friends and family. A second button on the device marked SOS would summon the sheriff's department. Christy stroked Ian's hair, and it occurred to her that the illness could also be a lesson. Would he come back from the threshold of life and death with profound insight? Or would the journey kill him? Perhaps there was more to his illness than met the eye. It was entirely possible that he had been cursed by powerful black magic. She considered the tools arrayed in front of her, a protection mantra, the goddess Kali, an emergency beacon. It was a test of faith informed by the fact that almost a decade earlier, her teacher, Michael Roach, took her as a sexual consort and later as his wife. Roach was not the first white man to travel to India and come back claiming to be enlightened, but he looked the part better than any of his predecessors. Roach bestowed Christie with the Tibetan title of Lama, and ever since, hundreds of devotees bent at her feet. For them, it meant she was a living goddess, a sort of messiah for a new breed of Buddhism that had only just gained a foothold in America. Now that they were on the run, Lama Christie McNally had to decide whether she would try to heal Thorson with her godlike powers or leave the responsibility to an outsider who would never understand that the path to enlightenment is not always straightforward or safe. As Lama Christie's finger hovered over the button on the emergency beacon, the stakes were higher than just life or death. Their very souls were on the line. Their very souls were on the line. That was the prologue to my brand new book, The Enlightenment Trap, Obsession, Madness, and Death on Diamond Mountain. And I really, really would appreciate it if you would give this book a chance. Take a listen. Tell me what you think. I really do believe that this is one of the most important books that I have ever written. I know that some of you have read my book, What Doesn't Kill Us, where I go into the ice and learn to totally change the way my body works in extreme environments. Well, I wrote that book right after I had been in this investigation for years. And I was such a skeptic of Wim Hof because of this event. And if you want to know the truth, the reason why I am suddenly looking at Wim Hof again with new eyes is because I was rereading this audiobook and I was realizing that some of the madness that I had captured in The Enlightenment Trap is still going on in a way that I had not expected inside the Wim Hof method. So, please, please, please go to my website, scottcarney.com, and there is a link to The Enlightenment Trap and all of the different formats that you can get it. But if you're an audio listener, well, maybe you just want to listen to the audiobook. It's available in all the places that audiobooks are available. Thank you. Thank you so much for being here. This is Scott Carney signing off from Denver, Colorado with Pokey Bear LLC. That's my company.